This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Yes, it is that time again. Very good afternoon to you. Good to have you along. Today, we'll take a look at why certain divisions within mining and energy companies are reluctant to embrace artificial intelligence. And then we'll take a look at how AI and also robotics are being used within the meat processing sector across Australia. And it's really being embraced by this particular agricultural sector, and it's proving to, well, make improvements right across the business, from animal welfare to even market access. So a good look at AI and robotics within a range of industries just after the news headlines at 12:30 today. 12:06 here on the Country Hour. First today, there's been a number of small frosts hit the southern agricultural region over the past fortnight, including one this morning. So far, it doesn't appear too severe, but agricultural consultants warn it's still too early to tell. Steve Curtin from Consult Ag says small frosts at this time of year are not unusual.
No, it's nothing new, and given the timing of the year, I mean, it's what we expect about this time of year. And a lot depends on the stage of the crop as well, because we had a very good start to the season. We've had a dry May and June, but the crops have been there, so that's been good. Then we've had an exceptional July and August, which is, those rainfall for those 2 months have been well above average, which has been great. And we've seen a great recovery in the season, much like we saw last year. But one of the things from that is that when the early start, and some areas are a little bit drier, and so we've got quite a staggered germination there in some paddocks. You wouldn't recognise it now, but it does allow the crops to have different maturities in this period of time.
And that's obviously good for that frost risk window.
Absolutely, yeah. So I've talked to a number of guys in the last few days, and we've got some crops that are, you know, we might have had, say, 10% tipped or something, which is, you know, minor with the yield expectations that we've got given the rainfall that we've had so far.
What are some of the yield expectations looking like?
Well, I'd say if we said, you know, there's some good 3-4 tonne crops out there potentially, yeah, I think we're well above the 2 tonne potential we would normally expect in this area.
So that's significantly above average?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's looking a good year, and I've talked to a lot of farmers, and they really are buoyant about the prospects for the crops this year.
Not out of the woods yet, though?
No. So we've still got the period of frost that I normally refer to from all the trial work we've done is that period of the 19th, 25th of September. So, no, we're not out of the woods yet. But I think given the crops that we've got, and one other factor too is the amount of rainfall we're having, and that keeps the ground moist. And when you get those sort of conditions, you know, the frost effect is usually a lot less than that. It's the dry soils we've got to worry about.
When will growers really know what sort of damage is out there?
No, look, we don't know yet. And I'd probably advise most people that, you know, you'll really start to see it 7 to 10 days after we've had the frost event. So it's the temperature it got to, and also for how long it got there. And these recent frosts haven't been there for very long, you know, so they've been short duration frosts, which are less damaging than the bigger ones.
And there are obviously options for growers if they want to take those options. We're still a while away if people need to cut for hay, but it does sound like none of those crops are at that severity that they need to take those options.
Yeah, look, that's the sort of drastic everything's been wiped out scenario, but I think most people are talking about very small percentages at the moment, and I think that's probably something we can handle this year at the moment.
Consult Ag Farm Advisor Steve Curtin speaking to Tara DeLandgraft. And Tara, who's our Esperance-based reporter, says it was frosty at Salmon Gums just north of Esperance this morning. It was below 0 degrees for about 3 hours and very still conditions. Tara did text around to a few farmers in that area just to see if they had concerns, and they reported that they were pretty hopeful the frost hasn't caused too much damage, but they're still holding their breath until they get to October, basically. But I wonder, if you've got any frost concerns at your place. It has been cold in the last couple of weeks. I wonder how cold it got at your place and how long was it at that temperature, because that makes all the difference, doesn't it? Let me know if you've got some concerns, because as Steve was just saying, you don't know really how much damage there is until sort of a couple of weeks later, 10-ish days later. So let me know on the text what's happened at your place. 0448 922 604. 10 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Well, across parts of WA during springtime, there is a flower that blooms so bright you can see it from space. Rolling golden fields of canola are lighting up the countryside from the Midwest to the South Coast, and it is a beautiful sight and also quite the money spinner. The crop generates billions of dollars for the Australian economy, and a recent report predicts more than half of this year's crop will be produced right here in WA. Peter Bird is a Senior Regional Manager West with the Grains Research and Development Corporation. He says canola was first introduced to WA back in the 1960s, all the way from Canada.
You know, it ticked along in that fairly small way for a number of decades until herbicide-tolerant canola was introduced in the 90s. And that's what really kicked things off. The ability for grain growers to grow canola and control some weeds at the same time, because it's a crop that typically in its natural state you can't use many herbicides on. But it's also been a very temperamental type of crop. The bugs love to eat it, and a disease called blackleg and other diseases kind of wiped it out in those early years. So it's a really great success story for Western Australian farmers. And like you say, it's now a big crop. It's something like 20% of the cropped area in Western Australia.
How much canola does Western Australia produce each year?
It goes up and down a bit. With the really strong pricing in the last 4 or 5 years, we've taken another jump on the back of that and some improved varieties and better practices. In terms of hectares, the latest this year, the GEWA crop report from this year is suggesting around 1.8, just under 1.8 million hectares, but it's been around that number or hovering around or a little less for kind of the last 4 years or so.
How does that figure compare to other parts of the country? Is WA the biggest canola producer?
In terms of state, it would be. In terms of the number of hectares, we in terms of tonnes produced, we probably typically produce something like 40% of the tonnes of canola across Australia. This year, though, reasonable number of hectares, and I just read the latest September ABARES crop report. They're suggesting that the national canola crop's going to be about 6.4 million tonnes this year, and WA expecting about 3.3. So this year, potentially 50% of the canola in Australia will be grown in WA.
Why do you think WA has been able to produce that much canola? Is the climate here just completely set up for it? Or why are we, you know, producing 50%, more than 50% of our crop?
Going back in history a little bit as well, we, you know, when we used to have a farming system where we ran a lot of sheep and we'd rotate our cereal crops, wheat and barley, with legume pastures. But as sheep have moved out of the farming system and we're continuously cropping, you know, a large part of our wheat belt now, we need rotational crops to break up the disease from our cereal crops, and we're not well suited to growing a range of other pulse crops, for example. We've grown a fair bit of lupins in the past, but canola has been a crop that as we've changed our soils, we've done a lot of work with our soils, research and farmer innovative practices to change the soils has lifted the pH. Canola is sensitive to low pH, so as we've been liming and mixing that through our soils, we've created soils that grow well. The investments that growers have made over the decades through GRDC has really led to a crop that's fairly reliable now, in that we can grow it in medium and low rainfall areas. There's still some risk there, but it's become kind of a reliable crop. And it's actually, talking to some farm management consultants recently, probably the best gross margin crop that farmers can grow. Pricing's good. The combination of excellent gross margin crop to grow and the ability to rotate away from cereals and give some good weed control is the reason why it's dominating as a rotational crop now.
Where does the crop mainly go? Where are we exporting it?
There's a lot these days going to Europe, another kind of success story. Quite a lot goes into biofuels. It's also an excellent and healthy food oil. So between Europe and Japan, for example, they take quite a bit of our canola as well. It goes into a mixture of biofuels and human consumption market. Also exported to markets like Taiwan, Japan, China, Vietnam through Southeast Asia.
So biofuel, how much of a demand is there for that at the moment, and how quickly do you expect that is going to grow, considering, you know, there is more of a focus these days towards renewable energy?
It's been one of the things that's been driving the pricing of canola, a little bit above what it would be normally if that wasn't the case. It goes into Europe, there's mandates there for biofuel. I can't talk in much detail about the future and how that looks, but I know there's a lot of excitement about SAF, or sustainable aviation fuel. It might be another potential avenue.
Recently, we've seen satellite images of canola. You can actually see it from space. How cool do you think that is?
Yeah, it's cool. And to tell you the truth, I'm not surprised because, gee whiz, it's very bright, isn't it? And there's some really big, you know, 20% of the wheat belt in canola and some quite big chunks of canola. Another way that growers manage disease is to try and block plant their canola. So they'll plant a big, you know, many paddocks together in a block and then, you know, next year move that to a different place so the disease isn't carried over as much from one year to the next. But these, you know, big blocks of canola and 20% of the landscape in canola, it's, you know, quite significant.
The GRDC's Peter Bird speaking to Amelia Searson. Mark Walter produces about 2,000 hectares of canola at his farm at Cascade, west of Esperance. He says while he's not quite game enough to put an exact figure on this year's yields, this could be his best season yet.
It's been a pretty good canola year. Yeah, we had a good, really good early start, 40 mil through March there, so we seeded a reasonable amount of the canola early and then had 120 mils in Easter time, so we reseeded a fair bit of portion of that, or 700 hectares, and but the rest went in pretty well after that and looks really good at the moment.
Any early indications of what it might yield?
I wouldn't be game to say, but yeah, it'll be one of the probably nearly our best canola year, I would have thought, overall, on average. But some of the real early stuff that we didn't reseed that was put in before the big rain is patchy, I guess, but it's evened out a lot, and yeah, it's potted up well. So, and then some of the our reseeded stuff, which was reseeded late April, is looks really good, but still full flower, so still got a way to go yet.
How much did you put in overall?
We put in just over 2,000 hectares of canola. Yep.
And how integral is canola in your overall farming system?
It's a pretty good fit. We do about a third of our cropping program is canola. And, yeah, it's been good financially for us over the last period of time. And as long as we get an early break and get it in and up, it goes well.
So it's something you'll continue to do as long as it does its thing?
Yeah, we'll definitely keep growing. Yeah, similar hectares of canola every year, and just play with the rest of them to keep that, the rest of the crops to keep that even.
Esperance is the biggest canola producing district in the nation. You're sort of seeing that your neighbours, they all value it as part of their system too?
Yeah, well, I guess it started on the coast and worked its way north, the canola, and grows really well and yields well in the sandier gravel soils where they get higher rain, but it's the varieties are getting better all the time, and if we can get crops in early in the more northern areas, they grow well and consistently yield reasonably well, a lot more consistent than what they used to be.
Cascade canola farmer Mark Walter speaking to Tara de Landgraft. And you can read more about this story. It's online for you now. And while you're there, just check out some of the spectacular photos of this year's canola fields on that story. So to find it, just search ABC Rural and Satellite Canola. And make sure you do. The photos are great, especially those satellite ones are really great. And, of course, there's the ones on the ground with the beautiful fields of yellow. 19 past 12. We'll check in with the news headlines shortly and then a look at the weather right across Western Australia. First, the state government is expanding its container deposit scheme. From the 1st of July next year, you can get 10 cents back when you return glass, wine and spirit bottles wine and water casks, as well as containers for concentrated fruit and vegetable juices, flavoured milk and cordial. Pretty much everything except plain milk and registered health tonic containers. The 10-cent reward for these containers comes from the companies that make the drinks, who pay a fee per container to cover the cost of the refunds and also operating the scheme. Rory Binney runs a southwest distillery that produces small batch spirits. He says this is just an extra cost that's going to make it harder for local companies to remain in business serving the local market.
The scheme and the concept's a really good idea. However, the time frame regarding how much time you have before it becomes a sort of mandatory thing on the label is perhaps a little bit in the kick in the guts. You're trying to save money by sort of buying labels in bulk. Now we're having to change those labels, or they're invalid in another 7 or 8 months. It just makes it sort of hard for the sort of smaller batch stuff we do and that sort of side of it. So I think the scheme itself and the idea is certainly good, but realistically we'd want at least 2 years before you can for us to sort of properly gather and readjust labels if we need to and stock levels and a few other things.
Do you think that it's fair for the producer to be the one who is essentially paying for the 10-cent payout?
No, certainly not. We're in a market, I think, or in today's world where, you know, the cost of living, everything's sort of going up. And any little thing, whether it's a 10 cents or it's a administration fee, and I'm sure the last thing distillers, brewers and wineries want is more paperwork, B, more costs, and C, like a lack of understanding of the industry, where it does feel like, you know, with excise, for distilleries, certainly for spirits, it's going up every 6 months, and certainly feels a little bit unfair.
And obviously being in the southwest, like distilleries, wineries, they're a pretty big part of tourism and the economy. Do you think that the alcohol industry is sufficiently recognised, you know, for its contributions to the economy?
Yeah, I think yes and no. I think there certainly needs to be a bit more of a look into how we should be helping these businesses. We're getting to a spot now where wineries, or certainly wineries and distilleries, are looking to export because that's the sort of it's more affordable to sell bottles overseas than it is in Australia in some capacity. So we really want to be the other way around, where it should be really important, really encouraging, I guess, us to support local and to get around each other with the Australian people buying Australian products. But it does feel like perhaps at times we're getting overlooked, and this perhaps feels like it's just another little kick in the guts. Not only the distilleries and breweries, and it's not only the businesses that are paying for it, but the actual customers will be as well.
A bit of a broader question, maybe just to finish on, how is the industry going? Like, how's the company going? Are there any other headwinds or opportunities?
Exporting for us is way earlier than I first anticipated, because of that excise. You know, if I can sell a bottle of gin here for $70, that's great, but I can sell it to China for $50 and make more. It's the people that are missing out on that good quality wine or spirit, because it's the way that it's sort of the excise is set up and the wet tax and a few other things.
I don't know if this is the same case as with beer, but I know beer has seen a bit of a spike in interest in China since the US tariffs made it like harder for them to buy US beers in China. Is it at all the same with the distilleries?
Yeah, certainly with distilleries that do like rum and whiskey, like there's like bourbon. If there's an opportunity or like a gap in the market, we want to be seen as, if America are the bad guys, we want to be seen as the good guys.
Rory Binney from Cuprin Distillery in Bunbury. It produces small batch gins, liqueurs, whiskey, rum and vodka. He was speaking to Bridget MacArthur about the news that the state government has just expanded its container deposit scheme. And since its launch in 2020, more than 4.5 billion containers have been collected. And this expansion to include all sorts of other beverages is expected to add about another 200 million containers every year. 24 past 12.
The Country Hour, part of your community and your life.
It's nostalgic.
For 80 years.
Hanging out with my brothers in the back of a ute.
The Country Hour.
They just naturally grow a beautiful shape.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
The Bureau of Meteorology has made some big changes to the way it assesses El Niño and La Niña. These events are the world's biggest drivers of weather. But global warming has made it harder for forecasters to predict the behaviour of what they call ENSO, which is the El Niño La Niña pattern. Matthew Wheeler from the Bureau says the new tracking system cuts out ocean temperature data because the world's warming waters are throwing off the El Niño index.
Previously, we had an index for the El Niño and La Niña, which was the ocean temperatures in the Central Pacific compared to the historical average. And due to global warming, that index has been getting warmer, so it was influenced by not just ENSO, but global warming. And in order to get it focused back on the ENSO as a phenomena and the year-to-year variability it introduces to our climate, we introduced what we are calling the relative Niño index, and it subtracts out the global warming signature from the traditional one to give it this new index to focus just on ENSO.
How does the warming data kind of skew understanding of El Niño?
It means that if we had have continued using the current index, in another 20 or 30 years, it may have always been showing El Niño. And that's not useful for the communication of El Niño and La Niña if you never had a La Niña because of the warming in the index. So with the new index, we will still get that year-to-year variability as one of the influences that influences Australian climate.
Is El Niño and La Niña, are they things that we should be focusing on, though, when we want to know what's happening with the weather and the climate?
El Niño and La Niña are just one of the many influences on our climate. And in the first instance, we want farmers, graziers, everyone in the community to look at our forecasts of rainfall and temperature over Australia, which is coming from our global model that takes into account all those influences together. And so that should be the first port of call. And so this change, the index, is just a way that we scientists monitor the phenomenon and how we communicate what our forecasts are doing. So it doesn't change our forecasts of rainfall and temperature, just changes the communication and interpretation of it.
Can folks get a bit too caught up on the El Niño, La Niña binary and perhaps take too much away from what that might mean about what's coming up for the season and the weather?
Yeah, they can, and that has been a danger in previous years where they've just used the El Niño and La Niña instead of to make decisions instead of looking at the forecasts of rainfall and temperature over Australia. So, yes, they can get too caught up on it, and we want them to look at the rainfall forecast itself.
So for agricultural producers in Australia, what would you like them to do now? Do they need to change their behaviour? Should they be looking in different places on the Bureau website for information?
The information on the Bureau website remains in the same locations. If they were using just El Niño and La Niña to make decisions, then we want them to look at the long-range rainfall and temperature forecasts instead, because that is our best estimate of the influence from all these different climate drivers on our forecast.
So stick to the seasonal outlook, stick to the forecast?
Yeah, exactly.
Matthew Wheeler from the Bureau of Meteorology's Seasonal Climate Processes team, speaking to Fiona Broom. And of course, we'll head to the Bureau of Meteorology locally shortly and just look right across the state, checking the conditions for you. First, though, Jonathan Hopper is in the studio with the news headlines.
Good afternoon, Belinda. WA's Transport Minister says a long-awaited overhaul of the public transport ticketing system should be ready to roll out by the end of the year. The project is more than a year behind schedule and comes at an additional cost of $10 million. Upgrades to the ticketing system will allow people to use their phones and credit or debit cards to pay bus, train and ferry fares. An elderly woman who was struck by a van on a zebra crossing in Albany CBD has been flown to Royal Perth Hospital overnight. The 81-year-old was struck about 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon while crossing Albany Highway near York Street on a mobility scooter. Emergency services worked to free the woman who became trapped between the van and scooter. Dockers defender James Aish has called time on his AFL career after 186 games across three clubs. The 29-year-old wasn't offered a contract beyond this season and managed just three games for Fremantle in 2025 after playing 20 in 2024. Thanks, Belinda.
Jonathan, thank you for the update. This is the Country Hour, 12:30, and between now and the news at 1, we'll take a look at why there are certain divisions within mining and energy companies that are not quite embracing artificial intelligence at this stage. And then we'll take a look at, in contrast, I guess, what's going on in the meat processing sector, which is really taking a look at AI and also robotics and how it can really improve efficiencies, even open market opportunities into the future. And just before one, it's off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market. First, though, making our way to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Grace Abbott is with you today. Grace, let's take a look across the Southwest Land Division.
Yeah, cheers, Bao. Look, the story is remaining much the same. So we do have a ridge-dominated pattern through to Friday and then looking pretty windy and wet this weekend in the southwest. So like you said, for the south, following some fog and frost clearing from the inland southwest land division this morning, there isn't much to touch on for today. Most of the cloud has retracted into the Eucla district and there's no further showers expected out of that. Now, we're in for another sunny one tomorrow after an overnight minimum. Temperatures are largely remaining above 4 degrees in the Southwest Land Division tonight. So some of those maximum temperatures for tomorrow are ranging from 29 degrees up in Kalbarri through 27 at Geraldton, down to the 24s and 25s around Beacon and York, and down to 21 to 22 degrees at Margaret River through to Albany. Now, that is due to a cold front on the way, which is freshening winds ahead of it out of the north, and that's moving some warmer air overhead. So into Saturday, we do have a prefrontal cloud band, which is going to deliver some early showers to the west, followed by a front arriving in the southwest later in the morning. Now, Bal, I misheard your question yesterday, so I'll answer it now. I think you were going to ask about the cloud cover for those sort of in the ag areas. So those in the eastern agricultural areas, so about Beacon and Meriden and Hyden, will have quite a bit of time after sunrise before those showers reach them, roughly around midday. As for the rainfall, some of those heaviest falls of around 5 to 15 millimetres are forecast southwest of Perth to Albany, with some isolated totals around 25 millimetres. Outside of that, we're looking at 3 to 10 for those southwest of Kalbarri through to Bremer Bay, and dropping off to 1 to 4 millimetres if you're around the Mulawa through to Brookton and Ravensthorpe areas, and then less than 1 millimetres south of Carnarvon through to Kalgoorlie. Now, the windiest front is coming through on Sunday, so there are two, and the second one's on Sunday, bringing some gusty thunderstorms possible about parts of the southwest and the south coasts. Now, these showers will be moving pretty quickly, steered by some pretty strong winds aloft, so again, definitely looking quite gusty. But as for the rainfall, we have a further 5 to 15 millimetres southwest of Perth to Albany, looking around 3 to 10 millimetres southwest of Lanceland to around Lake Grace, and about 1 to 4 millimetres for the remainder of the Southwest Land Division. Now, for Monday, rain is dropping off to less than 2 millimetres over the Southwest Land Division in a southwesterly flow as a cold air mass moves overhead, and that's going to lead to some possible small hail on Monday morning about the south coastal district, and also some possible frost in the inland Southwest Land Division on Tuesday.
All right, thank you for that. Following up on that too, I appreciate it. And now let's look across northern and eastern parts of WA.
Yeah, so we've had some gusty southeasterlies this morning, steered by that ridge in the south, up over the north. We recorded a 60 km/h gust in Port Hedland, just to give you a rough idea of how gusty we're talking. Now, those gusty conditions are returning tomorrow before easing this weekend as that ridge moves off into southeast Australia. Now, today is also the last day for a possible afternoon shower and storm in the North Kimberley before that trough is going to move further north up over the waters. So therefore, it's looking pretty dry up in the Kimberley region beyond this weekend, or beyond tomorrow rather. We turn our attention to the state's northwest with the prefrontal cloud band that's lingering from Saturday into Sunday and looking to bring less than 6 millimetres from about Carnarvon inland past Meekatharra to possibly Leonora. Rainfall will then clear out of the north for those up that way into the new week, but still a bit of a watch point for the amount of rainfall that we'll get out of this cloud band. Just waiting to see for a little bit more model alignment, hopefully tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Grace.
Cheers, Belle.
Cheers. It is 26 to 1. Richard Hudson in the studio taking a look at the rainfall results.
Yeah, hardly any at all. The only region to get any rain at all was the Kimberley. Diggers Rest had 6 mils, Drysdale River Station 17 and Kununurra 5. Nowhere else in WA had any rain at all. But earlier on, Belle, you were talking about frost. And just had a chat to Andrew from Ravensthorpe on the south coast. And less than 2 weeks ago, so on the 31st of August, they had some really cold conditions. And unfortunately, it was for a prolonged period of time, -1 for about 9 hours. The coldest it got was -3.8 degrees. He reckons that's probably the worst cold and prolonged period he's had, possibly ever. Feel for you, Andrew, and also for anyone else in that area or any other area that has had some frost conditions like that. Hope the damage hasn't been too bad anyway. Hey, we're going to touch on artificial intelligence now for a few reasons, but one of them is because large mining and energy companies operating in Australia, it looks like they've been pretty slow to embrace AI in their finance divisions. And that was one of the main findings in a report that was released this morning by Perth-based company Access Analytic. Managing Director Jeff Robson says they surveyed the chief financial officers of 60 companies, and two-thirds of the respondents from the mining industry, so from mining companies, said they had no plans to use AI, and he wasn't expecting that.
It did surprise us, yeah. And surprise us and also concerned us, because it's something that is majorly changing organisations and it's happening very rapidly. So if we are not making any plans to use AI, or if we have no interest in that, like it's really going to be a long way behind.
In your survey, did you find out why those mining companies are not embracing AI?
The question was, what are the barriers to AI adoption? And the two biggest things that were cited were data privacy concerns and also difficulty in accessing expertise to help with this. The third reason that came in was we're uncertain about where to start. So those were sort of our top three areas.
I can understand the concern about losing data. If you are involving artificial intelligence, you'd probably be worried that any data to do with your finance could go out into that world wide web.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a very valid concern, and people should be very concerned about privacy and confidentiality, particularly when it's, you know, information that's proprietary and you don't want competitors or, you know, people outside your organisation getting access to that. There are ways that we can address this, however. So you can run AI privately, basically. It doesn't have to be used just using the publicly available models and so on. So it doesn't have to be a concern, it doesn't need to be something that necessarily stops you, but that was the number one issue that people cited.
For a CFO that's listening, though, what would be the advantages of using AI?
Well, there's a lot of advantages. So things like improving productivity, identifying new opportunities, this would be for revenues or for saving cost, using AI to enhance your data analysis, so you'd be able to do things faster and quicker and easier.
Writing reports?
Yeah, absolutely. Writing reports, writing all sorts of different things that, you know, we need to write. So whether it's reports or whether it's policies and procedures, whether it's, you know, even, you know, communications to various stakeholders, you know, there's a lot of different areas where AI can certainly provide a lot of help and do a lot of the heavy lifting. Obviously, you don't necessarily want to just, you know, copy-paste, of course, but you do want to make use of it to do a lot of the hard work for you, and then you can refine it from there and add areas and nuances and so on that the AIs are not so good at.
Is one of the advantages of AI that you can ask quite specific questions and then get specific answers for your company?
Yes, yep, for sure. So if you've got the data available, you can ask some very specific questions, and the better the quality of the data, the better the responses that you'll get back. So you can be quite specific in the questions that you ask, and if you've got, you know, what the other example that you probably saw that we mentioned this morning was in relation to budgeting and forecasting and having AI involved in that process and being able to ask specific questions about your financial data just using natural languages. So you could say, for example, you know, what were my 10 best customers, or, you know, which part of my company is performing best, what were my 10 biggest costs, or, you know, things of that nature, or just using natural language. You don't need to write queries, you don't need to wait for someone to create a report for you or anything like that. You can just ask questions about your data and get specific answers back.
So what would your advice be to anyone who is still a bit slow to get onto the AI bandwagon?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's certainly better to make a start. And you don't have to start by reinventing the wheel or doing some massive, you know, million-dollar project or anything like that. You can start small and make some smart mistakes and try and do that earlier rather than waiting until it's perhaps too late and then you're trying to play catch-up.
If you are playing catch-up, is that such a bad thing?
It just puts you behind, I suppose. If you're, for example, if your competitors are able to do things faster, more efficiently, at a lower cost, that puts you at a disadvantage if you are playing catch-up with them. So, you know, it's still early days, so it's not, you know, no one has got their stuff together in this area, if we put it that way. But, you know, it's good to be experimenting, to be starting, and the research showed that the majority of people and the majority of companies have actually made a start, at least in these areas.
Do you think one of the reasons for these findings, Jeff, is the age of the respondents? I'm not great with tech and apps and new fandangled crap, and I'm wondering if the age of CEOs or CFOs is similar to me. Do you think you might have had a different response if the respondents were younger?
Possibly, although we were asking them about how they're using it within their finance division, not necessarily how they themselves are actually using the technology. So if someone is uncomfortable with the technology, you know, you can find perhaps others around you that are a little more comfortable in using the technology that might be able to do those kinds of things for you, or at least, or maybe show you how you can do things. And the other part, I suppose, is that, you know, you can, as a non-technical person, the AI can actually make it much, much easier for you to do the queries and ask questions and so on, because you can ask it just by talking to it, for example, or you can ask it by typing a natural language query. So by that, I just mean just typing a sentence and saying, what about this? And what was my biggest thing here? What was my, you know, my lowest cost here, or which team is performing better, or, you know, those kinds of things, and give me a chart. So you don't need to be a technical person to type a sentence.
Jeff Robson is the Managing Director of Access Analytics Solutions. He was speaking to Richard Hudson about a report he released just this morning. It contains data collated from more than 60 companies, some of which had revenues of more than $1 billion, and the majority of those surveyed were mining companies from WA. Two-thirds of those mining companies said they had no plans to use artificial intelligence in their finance department. What do you make of that? And I wonder if you're using AI in your organisation. How are you using it, or why are you choosing not to use it? Let me know. 0448 922 604. Text through. Be part of the conversation here on the Country Hour this afternoon. 17 to 1. The Australian meat processing sector is certainly embracing artificial intelligence and robotics, with some of the latest technology showcased on the Gold Coast this week. Edwina Tui is the CEO of the Australian Meat Processor Corporation. That's the research and development arm of the industry which hosted this event. She says the new tech is helping to improve all aspects of the meat processing business, from the safety of workers on the floor to better understanding of what the buyers want.
The market access work that we were doing was really to understand what temperatures we really need to send our product overseas or to store our product. So currently we store it at minus 18. we've done a lot of research around food safety as well as meat quality to determine that actually that temperature might be not what we need to send it, so we can actually send it safely at minus 12. However, we need the science to back up what we're doing so then we can have those conversations with our partners. The robotics and automation work that we've been doing will be showcasing, I think we've got some presentations around the brief scribe work that we've been doing, and that's really around improving worker safety but also around increasing precision and processing efficiency as well. The task is actually quite manual and quite labour intensive, and by automating some of that process we actually make it a lot safer for our workers, but also we increase our accuracy and then therefore our yield potential as well.
You talked about sustainability. Where does the red meat, the processing side of the industry sit when it comes to reducing carbon emissions, and what work is being done in that space?
We punch really well above our weight, I think, in our contributions to decarbonisation and getting to net zero. So we've got a lot of initiatives. One project, which has been going since 1998, is actually our environmental performance reporting program. So we do a benchmarking program every 2 years. And what that does is it can identify problem areas across an industry, but also down to individual plants. So the plants that participate in this, and that's been growing year on year, the amount of plants that want to participate in this program, because they get detailed understanding, you know, there could be a high water usage here, how do we do it better? There could be a high energy usage in this process, how do we do it better? And because it's such an ecosystem on plant, if you make one change, you've got to look at the flow and effects. So it's been a really, really great program, because what it does is it shows how we've improved over time.
Have you been able to see a massive reduction in emissions?
Absolutely. We have two carbon neutral plants that operate in Australia, and we've got many, many striving towards that as well, which is, you know, for a highly intensive operation in manufacturing, I think, again, the red meat processing industry is really leading the way in many ways.
You lead the research and development arm of the processing industry in Australia. Where do you see the industry in the future?
We have to continue to innovate, and I think we have to take our members on the journey. So for me, this innovation showcase is just one step in how we take them on the journey. I've got a research background, and I look where I started 20 years ago in doing research, and I look at the changes that we see in simple tasks throughout the plant. So look, I see us continuing to innovate. I can see our workforce of the future been bright and such a unique industry where, you know, we require everything from your first school leavers looking for a job to doctors, to nurses, to lawyers, to engineers, to scientists, to computer and analysts. So it's such a diverse career path, and I think anyone living in rural and regional communities can really start to think, if they've got a processing plant within their area, they should be thinking about what career opportunities there are, because it's such a different workforce, and it's also a workforce that will continue to evolve as technology increases.
Australian Meat Processor Corporation CEO Edwina Tui. She was speaking to Megan Hughes, 13 to 1. Well, as Megan was just saying, or actually Edwina was just saying, artificial intelligence is being trialled in Australian meatworks to improve animal welfare outcomes. Impetus Animal Welfare has created a system. It's called Argus. CEO Michael Patching says it uses a combination of CCTV and sensors placed throughout the processing facility.
If you just use video alone and you're using machine vision, then it's kind of limited, and the amount of computation and effort to be able to learn what's going on from just vision is limited to what, number one, the vision can see, and also how long it takes to be able to analyse and interpret what the vision is seeing. So the vision is useful as a tool, and it just uses normal CCTV cameras to be able to analyse some of that vision for counting of animals or looking for when they're down or isolated. And it also uses sensors such as Internet of Things connectivity with electric prods, or it could be gates to see when a gate has opened and closed, or in the stun box to look at how long the animal's in the stun box and when the stunner has been fired, or when another captive bolt's been pulled out. And all of these things together combine to give a better picture when things aren't probably going the way they need to, or really just to be able to get better metrics on how often specific things are happening to indicate when training needs to be offered to staff, or when there may need to be some investment in infrastructure or layout or whatever. So there's just a lot more data being provided to the businesses to be able to make more informed decisions.
Have you trialled this at a couple of different meatworks now?
Yeah, we've got one working at a cattle abattoir and another one working at a mixed small stock facility, and both facilities have different needs within the system and, you know, getting different value out of it, which is kind of also kind of important to sort of note that these systems aren't really plug and play, at least at this stage. They're not really plug and play and use. They're really useful for businesses for different reasons, because different facilities are designed differently and they have different risks or different operating procedures. So working out how they work within the actual business is kind of a mission. But the ones that are working within the businesses seem to be providing, yes, some really nice data and creating some really cool interventions in those businesses.
So that has resulted in changed behaviour at these processes?
Yeah, it's early. The short answer is yes. Yeah, it definitely have resulted in understanding where the risks are and some changes happening, you know, decrease in electric prod use or improvement in race design, and a whole lot of other things have fallen out of this already. We have training aids that we also build to help support with ongoing learning, and I guess a fallout from that is then they're using the training aids, and those training aids are then feeding back to improvement in outcomes that we can then monitor with the AI technology as well.
Who has access to the data?
They do. It's their data. They hold the data, and they're the ones that control what happens to it and what they do with it, and therefore the decisions that they're making.
Where do you see this technology in the future?
It's interesting. So there's both an over understanding and a, you know, it's still trying to find its feet as to where it works. It really does come down to it is augmenting the ability to collect data throughout the day, throughout the operations. It's going to work best for businesses that are set up and ready for, you know, implementation of technology and that are digitally ready and also have the capabilities to then implement those changes within their businesses. For those businesses, it will increase the amount of information that they have to be able to make good decisions, which will then improve their capabilities. It will also be able to be used in the future, not yet, but in the future, to validate within a lot of those certification programs that they're meeting their requirements without having to do a lot of those manual audits that they're currently doing, which take time and effort and aren't as robust as this automated data collection.
Michael Patching, he's from Impetus Animal Welfare, and he was speaking to Megan Hughes. 8 minutes to 1. A satellite imagery and data company has won this year's Croc Pitch competition in the Northern Territory. This is an annual event, and it gives startup companies a chance to pitch their ideas and their innovations to a panel of judges for a chance to win up to $1 million in venture capital. Sebastian Chowey is the CEO and co-founder of Alula, which won this year's competition. He says the technology can help a range of industries such as defence and mining, and even help crack down on illegal fishing.
Alula is building the infrastructure to obtain satellite images from orbit in real time. It takes a while to get a high-res satellite image today. There are about 1,800 imaging satellites of various forms in orbit around our planet today. By 2033, that number is going to balloon to 5,400 according to some projections. Now, the issue isn't having more sensors in orbit to image the Earth. It's about coordinating those sensors effectively to solve real problems for industry.
In terms of time, how quick could it get?
Well, our vision, our mission is to get it, you know, near instantaneous, where you're opening up your phone and you can see a satellite image or maybe even a processed image with the analytics and the output, say maybe spray here or mine there or something like that in minutes, right? That's where we want to get to. And it's really about coordinating the satellites already up there to effectively do that at scale, and then managing the data once it's down to Earth and delivering that to the end users in a meaningful and fast way.
So getting that information in minutes rather than hours or days.
Yeah, absolutely. It can take, we've worked with some satellite operators and it takes them days to, you know, from a request being put in to an image being delivered, it can take days to capture that. And so a lot of that is due to the business process that they implement, the fact that a lot of their scheduling systems are manual, lots of humans in the loop. And by automating that, we can really drive and increase the speed of acquisition of data.
One of your slides today at Croc Pitch mentioned illegal fishing in Australia's northern waters. Can you explain how your tech could help that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the issue of illegal fishing is really comes down to vessel detection, right? And so we've already got a lot of really interesting technologies that can spot a vessel, you know, radars can spot a vessel, but is it a vessel that is worth inspecting? Is it worth flying out? Is it worth going up to them and actually figuring out whether or not they're illegally fishing in the area? Well, you need some eyes on that vessel as well. And so we're actually building the technology that takes that radar data, that ping that we're getting, and then coordinates the next available satellite to quickly capture over that location to see if we can identify or get some sort of features about that vessel. And that is a step that's missing right now in our current, what we call maritime domain awareness architecture. You know, we've got the radars and then we send the really expensive drones or boats out. But imagine if you could get a low-cost satellite to see, oh, well, actually, that's a, you know, that's a...
It's just Craig and his mates on a fishing trip.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, we know Craig, and so he's fine. But those other guys down the estuary or something like that, or maybe out in the sea, they're the ones that we need to be worrying about. So being able to ID those vessels much faster, especially when they turn their transponders off, their radios off as well, that can be an issue. So being able to sniff those out and coordinate all the satellites that can do that in conjunction with some of the sensors and radar systems that we've already got to create a really unique and useful solution.
Is it fair to say your tech at the moment's really been pitched towards the Defence Force?
Yeah. Alula has really been born in defence, right? Where they've got the greatest needs and they're spending the most amount of money. But my vision is to really commercialise this technology so it's useful to everyday people as well. The next step is maybe mining and resources sectors. But, you know, there are opportunities to leverage satellite imagery in things like real estate as well. But we need to get the solution fast enough to be able to use it effectively in those other kinds of downstream applications. And that's really the mission of Alula, is to automate all of this stuff in between the satellite in space and the end user to make it so quick and so easy that it's a no-brainer to start using satellites.
And winning Croc Pitch today, well done. What does it mean to you?
Thank you. It's a great honour. You know, my team and I have been working on perfecting this pitch, building up a case for investment to Paspalas and the Northern Territory government for months now. We've put a lot of blood, sweat and tears into it, and it's a huge opportunity for us not only to continue growing our business and securing new customers and also going globally, but to start setting up a base in Northern Australia, in particular Darwin. We see an opportunity to set up an Earth observation hub in the territory, bringing in other startups to work on remote sensing technologies and driving that innovation here.
Sebastian Chowie, he's from Alula, which won this year's Croc Pitch competition in the Northern Territory. He was speaking to Matt Brann. 3-1.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. An outpouring of grief over the assassination of a conservative influencer and right-wing debater, Charlie Kirk, shot dead at a Utah university. Flooding rips through the Indonesian island of Bali with more than 10 dead. A vacuum of power in Nepal created by the resignation of the PM fuels further instability. And the loudest and clearest ever sound of two black holes colliding 1.3 billion light years away. Join me for The World Today.
2:01. Tracy Kilner's been at the cattle sale at Mount Barker today. About 700 were on offer, so up about 50 on last week. Tracy, I hear prices were up a bit. Can you run through the details?
A mixed quality yarding dominated by young cattle, seeing medium weight Angus steer calves reach a top of 510 cents a kilo. A quality run of yearling heifers gained 15 cents, while a limited supply of trade weight cattle saw steers sell to 396 cents and heifers to 394 cents a kilo. Heavy cows eased with only local processors active, while the heavy bulls gained 10 cents with demand. The weaner steers sold from 470 to 488 cents for the heavyweights, and from 434 to 510 cents for lighter weights. Weena Heifers made 358 to 400 cents for the heavyweights and from 326 to 390 cents for lighter weights. Yearling cattle gained with steers selling from 400 to 472 cents, while the yearling heifers returned 358 to 406 cents a kilo. Grown steers weighing over 500 kilos made 330 to 396 cents. Grown heifers weighing under 540 kilos eased on last week's gain, selling from 330 to 380 cents. And the heavier weight heifers were up 10 cents, returning 352 to 394 cents a kilo. Heavyweight cows sold from 300 to 358 cents, and store cows made 218 to 297 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls sold from 250 cents up to 342 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you so much for that, Tracy. A total of 708 head of cattle at Mount Barker today. That wraps up the livestock markets for this week. Tomorrow we'll check in on the wool sales with Justin Haydock. And it's been 3 weeks in a row where the prices have been rising at the wool market. We'll see if it's 4 weeks in a row tomorrow. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.